This is Jeff Blankford with
a never-before-aired conversation with the late Palestinian psychiatrist Dr. Iyad Sarraj, recorded in 2004 in Gaza. Sarraj, who died in 2013 from cancer at age 69, was Gaza's first and most distinguished psychiatrist. Born in Palestine under the British mandate in what is now the Israeli town of Beersheba, he arrived with his family in Gaza as refugees in 1948. After his father and brother were arrested and imprisoned when Israel occupied the Gaza Strip in 1967, Sarraj left to study and graduated from Alexandria University in Egypt and the Institute of Psychiatry in London. Returning to Gaza, he lived through the violence of the Israeli military during the First Intifada in 1988, which left a new generation traumatized. He became Palestine's pioneer in the field of mental health research and treatment, and in 1990 founded the Gaza Community Mental Health Program and built a team of 40 specialists, many of them with the experience of Israel's prison, torture, and forced collaborations. The work of the Gaza Mental Health Program was supported by agencies around the world that recognized the importance of Sarraj's insights into Gaza's battered society, particularly the special needs of Gaza's children, women, and male victims of violence and torture in Israel's prisons. A prolific writer on the human cost of Israel's occupation, he was in demand as a speaker in Europe and the U.S. that went well beyond the medical world. After the signing of the Oslo Accords, Sarraj spoke out against the torture and violations of human rights by the Palestinian Authority. He paid for it in 1995 when he was arrested by the Palestinian Authority and given the very same treatment he had spoken out about. Two more arrests and beatings followed. He later treated the men who had beaten him. They were former prisoners in Israeli jails. Iyad Sarraj received many honors, including in 1997 the Physicians for Human Rights Award, and in 2010 he won the Olof Palm Prize for his efforts on behalf of his people, and was a key witness to the Goldstone Report and Israel's Operation Cast Lead 2008-2009, the first of Israel's three wars on Gaza in the past decade. And now here is Iyad Sarraj in 2004.
Let me just begin for people who don't know me or don't know what I'm doing. A small introduction. My name is Iyad Sarraj. I am a psychiatrist by profession. I started with the Gaza Community Mental Health Program in 1990. In the wake of the First Intifada. We were very keen on to study and to research and also to help children who were victimized at the time by what came to be known as the Children of the Stone, the Intifada. And later on we discovered that many of these children have problems at home. And the problem at home was related to the father or the mother or both of them. And in many cases we found that children were coming from families in which the mother was abused or the father was tortured in Israeli prison. So we expanded our work to these two areas, women, victims of domestic violence, and also prisoners who were victims of torture. Over the years, we have seen around 20,000 families over the last 15 years or so. And we found very important changes between the first Intifada and this Intifada, particularly when it comes to children. We found out that today's militants, today's suicide bombers, today's martyrs were the children of the first Intifada. If you take 10 years out of somebody whose age today is 20, he must have been like 10 in the first Intifada. And what is common among these people, the militants of today, particularly the suicide bombers, is an extreme traumatic experience during childhood involving the father. What is very important we have seen is that there is a special kind of relationship between the would-be martyr and the father figure. And we related to our first study in Gaza in 1990, which we conducted over the whole of Gaza Strip among 3,000 children, in which we found out that nearly 45% of them have witnessed the beating and the humiliation of their fathers when they were arrested by the Israeli soldiers. Because what happens is the child's image of the father as a symbol of power is shattered. And when we allowed some of the children, the famous game here, Arabs and Jews, many of our Palestinian children preferred to play the role of the Jew, because for them that was power. And what resulted, the result was violence, because they adopted the powerful figure, which has to exhibit violence against others. And they became violent against other children. But they had a long search for a replacement of the father figure. They always looked up to somebody to take the role of the father. And they couldn't find a hero to replace the father. When they are in their early teens, they find two things. One is the militant with the Kalashnikov, who is ready to say, I am powerful, I am not impotent as your father is, I can protect you with my gun, I am your hero. And they found the group that takes the place of the father. And usually it is the group of Hamas or Islamic Jihad or any other militant group that has certain highly disciplined system in which the children are adopted in, and the group becomes the father. Through this group, they even identify with the ultimate father, God. And God is victorious, never defeated, in comparison to the defeated father, physical father, the impotent father, and the demolished hope and dreams in childhood. We found out in a recent study among children in Gaza, 36% of the boys said that when they grow up, the best thing to do in life would be to become a martyr. 36. The best thing to do when you grow up is to become a martyr. 17% of the young girls said the same. That when you grow up, the best thing to do is to die as a martyr. The martyr now becomes a symbol of the, I believe, of the ultimate despair. This life is no more a place to look for, to live. There is no hope. There is no self-respect. The Palestinians are today are in a very serious situation. And I think that the inhuman environment in which they live in, which you have seen everywhere, and of course it is different between seeing and moving away back home than living. When you live here, it's a totally different story. And this is why in our most recent study, we found out that a third of the population of Gaza have more than 8 symptoms of depression, anxiety, or post-traumatic stress disorder that need intervention. Another third have less than AIDS symptoms, but still have symptoms, but somehow they can cope. Only less than 5% of the total population of our sample had exhibited no symptoms whatsoever. These are staggering statistics and results of recent studies which we conducted in Gaza, which tells you that the situation today and the future, I believe the future is going to be much worse, because the children of the first intifada were traumatized, the children of this intifada were severely traumatized, and it is only natural to expect traumatized people to traumatize others. Trauma and victimization moves from one generation to the other, and from one nation to the other. And the children who were in the first intifada just throwing stones, today they are suicide bombers. In the next 10 years or so, God imagine what can be the situation then.
Someone we spoke with earlier today at one of the centers, Dr. Musa, mentioned a psychologist, Maslow, who wrote about a self-actualization. Mm-hmm. Has there been any study made of that 5% you mentioned that hasn't been affected? Why have they been able to survive in the situation without those symptoms?
Well, I don't know, to be honest with you, but of course you would expect at least 5% of the people to be detached, to be isolated, to have the kind of defense mechanisms in which they manage to protect themselves even from exhibiting minor symptoms. It's only expected. In fact, we all have to use our own defense mechanisms against being affected by the situation. I have to do it consciously or unconsciously. This is what people do. This is how people cope. And there are so many defense mechanisms used to protect yourself from being affected. And I believe that the 5% of people who have shown no symptoms are in a situation in which their defense mechanisms were like perfect, right? But we don't know what happens deep inside, and later on perhaps it will change. Yeah.
Can you talk about how young girls cope with this occupation and how their mental health development might be different than it is for the young boys you talked about?
Well, you see, girls are traditionally in this place and most of the parts of the society living in a male-dominated environment. In which from the day they are born, they are assigned role, playing and aggressiveness and physical games are in the domain of boys, while girls are to look after dolls and prepare themselves to be housewives and mothers and so on. This is the traditional thing. They are, of course, an emerging layer of people who are educated, who have managed to educate their children, including girls, and that is changing the dynamics within that group. But generally speaking, this is the normal thing to have. Girls are. We found in one of the studies in the first intifada that girls were more anxious than boys in a conflict area where there's confrontation between Palestinians and Israelis. We were surprised to find that girls were more anxious than boys, and we tried to explain it by the fact that boys were active in the intifada and activity itself has lessened their anxieties, while girls were at home and they were somehow not able to express themselves physically the way children, boys do, and this is why the level of anxiety was higher among girls at that time. This time, we found out an observation which needs further study. It's only an observation that young girls today are more militant and more radically, politically radical than young boys. And young mothers particularly are much more radical in their political views than men, young wives. This is a very, not surprising to me, but very novel observation which we found in some of our studies, but we need to explore this further. But I believe this is going to be correct. Because women in traditional Arab society are not just the incubators of children, they're not just breastfeeding children and looking after them, they are the incubators of the culture and the tradition. And they carry this from one generation to the other. It is women who carry on the culture. And part of the culture is to protect, they encourage children. It is the women's role to encourage children to protect the land, the honor of the family, which means they have even to sacrifice themselves in the process. If you are a woman in an Arab desert, in the Arabian desert, and suddenly the husband is killed, it is the role of the mother or the wife to bring out the children, telling them all the time that they have to take revenge for the father's death. It is to protect the tribal honor. You only begin to understand Arabs and culture and the politics when you understand the tribe. But one of the impacts we found in our study of children of today was the impact of the uprooting in 1948, particularly in the cases of home demolition. And even in some cases in which the house was not demolished, but the image on the TV of a house being demolished has triggered memories in the minds of the people about their own homes in Palestine before 1948. And the verbal history of the people is well alive. So people talk to their children, and particularly mothers, talk to their children and their grandmother, talk about their stories of the home in Jaffa or Haifa or wherever, and talk about how they have to move from one that place to the refugee camp. And now the Israelis are after them and they demolish the home in the refugee camp, which tells them one single message: you have no place here, you have to leave, this place is for us. And for that, the immediate instinctual, an instinct reaction, we have to die for our honor. Even if that comes to that, we prefer to die to defend our honor. But of course, you are right, between 1948, if you look back, of course, I don't have any studies on that, but if you look from 1948, it took the Palestinians like 20 years before they started their armed struggle and the PLO and so on. But since the Israeli occupation, you can see the dramatic changes over the time. The psychology of people, the children growing up into militant youth and then transforming from one stage of development to the other, and then identifying at this stage to particularly with death and martyrdom as the way out of this life. I mean, this is like an extreme. I don't know what will happen in the future, but certainly, one layer is added to another layer. You know, between 1982 and now. We have seen cycles, and they are going like this, from a state, and this is reflected in the clinic. State of helplessness is expressed in cases of depression in the clinic. Then you have, when people feel that we have no hope whatsoever, we completely lost, then you have so many cases in the clinic of depression. Yeah, then they moved to a stage of restlessness and anxiety, which is reflected in cases in the clinic, and also when in our part of the world, women particularly start to look for fortune tellers and magic, black magicians, and so on. This is another stage. Then you come to a stage of anger. Anger that is expressed in violent outbursts within the community itself, fighting among families and tribes and so on. Then you move to the ultimate form of defiance, when people pour out into the streets in defiance. And then they have a kind of moral victory, which they believe they achieved by a kind of self-esteem and so on. And then later they realize that they have not been really victorious, and they go immediately to a state of helplessness and despair, and so on, and repeated. And each one, there has never been a kind of peaceful resolution. And, even when Arafat came here with the Oslo Agreement, it was the beginning of a new stage, which was an opportunity for the Palestinian community to start and go into a process of resolution, peaceful resolution, and reconciliation within itself. But it never happened. So you're going to go again to a new cycle. Without this process of reconciliation and peaceful resolution within the community, you only have to expect a new stage of violence and a new cycle.
Does this, how is it reflected over like economic lines? Do you find that the population, regardless of their economic situation, do you find the same kind of symptoms across all lines? Or?
Well, I tell you, of course, the general situation today is that the average person is poor in Gaza. The average person is poor. And even the people who are, we can say that we have a small middle class in which people can afford to live, but they are under serious pressure because tribally they have to provide to others. My salary is distributed, at least half of my income every month is distributed to other part of my small family, right? Because some of them are very poor, they cannot survive, they have lost their jobs. It is my duty, like the duty of other people in my family, to contribute to them, you know, so they can survive. So the same thing with her, the same thing with people who are managing somehow, because people come and look up to you to help them. So there is a strain over everyone. But the general population is poor. I mean, according to the World Bank, I think it is 60% of the people live under the poverty line. And poverty line here is different than the poverty line in somewhere else, too. You may have to remember. In Israel, the income per capita per year is something like $18,000. Here, it is $600. From $18,000 to $600. And now I think it is even less. So you can imagine the difference. While we drink the same water, the same coffee, and we import most of our food from Israel. So we have to pay the same prices. So what happens is that you have meat in Gaza. Of course you have meat, but not everybody can eat meat. You can go and look at it and wait for somebody to come as a charity to give you some meat. Right? Because this is the traditional thing of rich families here, is that they distribute meat to people in different occasions. Yeah. So, but everyone is suffering. I can assure you, everyone is trying to make ends meet, but there is a good percentage of people who are suffering miserably, and these people are everywhere. They are everywhere. And what happens, you know, and this is something that I need also to tell you about. Over the years, the Palestinians have developed a kind of curious profile. One hand, they are so dependent on charity. Being refugees in 1948, living in refugee camps, totally desolate, totally vulnerable and exposed and dependent on UNRWA, giving them food ration and shelter. Over the years, they became dependent on this. Now, a group of them managed to educate their children. So they went out to universities in Egypt and elsewhere, and they managed, like us, like here, managed to get some education and to get jobs. But what happens is that there are a huge number of people stayed in the refugee camps, and they are victims of a vicious cycle of poverty and ignorance and illiteracy and disease, and they are victim of this vicious cycle, and they cannot escape from, because when you are poor, you cannot educate your children, and when the children are not educated, they become poor, and when they are poor, they will have more children, and when they have their more children, they will be poor, and when they are poor, they become ignorant, and so on. So this is the impact of poverty on people's lives. Now, politically, people become under stress of the occupation, under stress of the poverty. They become very emotionally labile, to the extreme. And they can respond emotionally to calls like defiance and God is great, and let us go on all and die, and Allahu Akbar, and so on. These brings emotions in the people. It's like bring histories of suffering, and the call for kind of redemption when they join these calls. So the impact on the whole community is severe. It was in this place, I remember, in this place when during the Gulf War, I stayed in this place on my own, because the owner at that time was on herself, and I was living alone. So I decided that I decided to keep each other company. So I stayed in this hotel, and I remember at that time we were every night at the roof listening to the chanting of the people of Allahu Akbar, massive. God is great. Every time they see a missile coming from Baghdad hitting the Israeli cities sent by Saddam, they were all under curfew. No one was allowed to leave out their homes, but they were inside their homes looking at the skies and saying Allahu Akbar. Now God is coming to our help. It was so emotional that I remember a member of the British Parliament came and stayed here for one night, and he was in tears listening to this, because it was an expression of the desperate call of people who are so victimized. So at another level now, who are the militants? We in our study of the martyrs, the suicide bombers, we did not find poverty as a triggering factor. We could not find that being poor is something important or significant statistically to decide that you can become a suicide bomber. On the contrary, I mean, in many of the observations we found that children who become martyrs were coming from reasonably well-to-do families. But there is another impact of the economy on the image of the father, because traditionally here in the Arab society, that the functions have been very sharply decided between men and women. Women is to look after the home and the family and the culture. And men are to look outside to protect the family from the outside world by bringing peace and security and bringing money. Now what happens is that when men are unable to bring money, they lose some of that role. When they are unable to protect their families, they lose part of that role. And this is why you will have to expect in the future, it continues, that more women will move into the men's area and they will become the militant themselves. But it is still far from being realized, but it will come. If this situation continues and men continue to be impotent, unable to bring victory, more and more women will go into that area, as they did in the area of jobs. They will go into the area of military.
Before the first intifada, within the diaspora, many Palestinians, activists, saw the people of the West Bank and Gaza as in fact being impotent. And then when the first intifada came, it seemed to be, it was significant that it would be the first generation of people living in Gaza and in the West Bank who were born and had grown up under the Israeli military occupation. What is the significance of that?
Sorry, I lost you. The difference between two generations.
The generation, 20 years after the occupation, you know how the intifada, the children of the stones, were ones who had born, other than like their parents, had been born under Israeli occupation from the beginning.
Yes.
So they represented and had seen their parents generally acquiesce to the occupation.
True. And the other generation, their fathers, you mean?
The fathers from 67 had done nothing. It was the children and the growing up who had seen their fathers do nothing, and then were the ones who became the children of the stone.
You're absolutely right. You know, it took, as I told you first, about 20 years of the Palestinian new generation to start the PLO. It took then the invasion of Lebanon and the destruction of the PLO in Lebanon to move the focal of confrontation or resistance into the West Bank and Gaza. It was at that point that unconsciously the Palestinians here realized that we have to do it here. The PLO is out, it's finished. And then it was then that you started to see a thriving civil society. Syndicates, youth clubs, organizations, human rights organizations, civil society groups, and so on, that started to emerge. And then the culmination was the formation of the Palestinian United Leadership, which the Israelis are extremists after some time, if you remember, have put bombs under some of the people, and they killed Shaka, and not killed them, but they have to cut their limbs. Shaka and it was that kind of united leadership which culminated. And then, of course, the Intifada. The Intifada started as a reaction, as you said, exactly. It was a rebellion against the Israeli occupation, but it was also against the father authority, absolutely. And at that time, interestingly, women were almost going into this, but then suddenly they were prevented from men who felt so threatened. First, they are now the children are rebellious against them, and now women are moving out into the streets, and that was too much for men, so they went to the mosques and said, this is not good in Islam. Women have to go back. It is a shameful thing for women to be out in the streets. Women have to come back to the home, and they did. At that time also, men used tactics of intimidation against women. And they started to say that women who go out in the streets without the headscarf will be thrown at with sulfuric acid, whatever, to burn them. So they have to go home. The psychological reason was men were threatened by women coming out of the home.
Yeah. It's a different society.
It goes again with my theory, is that when the men stop being functioning as they are supposed to, then women have to move into that area. As exactly you compare it when women start to go out for jobs, when men stop bringing money in. And now if men are unable to protect them, either by absence or by being in prison or by killed or by impotence, women have to go out. And some in our case here in the last few years, you have seen, or you, I'm sure you have seen, some of the cases of women going out and becoming martyrs themselves. Now, I'm not sure about them because I have not studied them to tell you exactly if they fit in my theory or if they have personal problems that has propelled them into this.
When Arafat came back to Gaza after Oslo, I believe you were critical of what was going on, and could you tell us about that and what happened to you?
I was critical of Arafat before he arrived, and I continue to be critical of Arafat. Before he arrived, I made a press conference with Hanan Ashrawi in Jerusalem, and I was asked the question, what you would expect from Arafat when he arrives, and I said, I fear that what will happen is no peace, militarization, dictatorship, and corruption. I said that it is on record. I was asked this question in Jerusalem. And on the day of the arrival of Arafat, I was on top of this place, interviewed by the BBC World Service. And they asked me, what do you expect of this man coming? How do you feel about him? And I said, I feel happy that this man is coming back home with so many other Palestinians. But I feel sad that this will not be the beginning of peace or democracy in Palestine. Many people were critical of what I'm saying, but I knew the man, and I knew what is going to happen because I knew also the culture of the PLO. The culture of the PLO is a culture that lived outside the law, secret, clandestine organization, no transparency, no culture of democracy or the rule of law. And suddenly, they are coming here to rule with the law. And it was impossible. Especially that you have here a generation or a layer of people in the administration who were nurtured by the Israelis not to take decisions. Because the Israelis would decide everything for the Palestinians. I was a director of a hospital at that time in Gaza. And I was not allowed to know my budget by the Israelis. Now the Palestinians come from Tunis, absolutely corrupt, finding people who are unable to decide. So they had to take this to decide for them and for everybody else. And that was a dynamite mixture for corruption. Now also traditionally, Palestinians in Gaza have excelled in corrupting the rulers because the rulers have always been foreign and alien, and we managed to corrupt them all. Turks, Egyptians, British, Israelis too. Then the general governor of Gaza once was caught red-handed by Moshe Dayan when he was receiving a bribe from a businessman in Gaza. They managed it. So with the Palestinian Authority people coming from Tunis, hungry for money and for power and so on, and you have a population here that is ready to corrupt the ruler, then you have that mixture. So my call at that time to be careful and to correct things and not to be hypocrites, which is a common thing here, to be hypocrites. So we are critical of Arafat when we are in our inner circle. We develop a kind of two sets of languages. One is our private talk, which we are very critical of everything, and then one is public, which we are afraid of saying anything, or we want to praise the ruler, because he's a symbol of the nation, he's this and he's that, or we need some money from him, or some benefits, or some power. And this is a sad thing, but it is true. So this is, the population here somehow was the majority were the majority who do not share, do not speak, do not the silent majority. But they were also living on the hope. You see, Arafat was accepted and was tolerated for one thing. When he came here, he did not bring Jerusalem, he did not bring a state, he did not bring the refugees back, he did not bring anything. He just brought hope. And people were living on hope. And they were so tolerant of Arafat and his authority, believing that one day this hope will be realized.
That was the voice for the last 40 minutes of Iyad Sarraj, Palestinian psychiatrist, passed away in 2013, recorded in Gaza City in 2004 when I was there with a group for the Middle East Children's Alliance, whose voices you also heard on that very extraordinary interview, Insight into Palestinian and Gaza Society. Iyad Sarraj, rest in peace. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.